The senator from Sitka, I think, he thought up a better mousetrap. An interesting twist on an old device.
Lawmakers and the governor aren't making any progress on a budget deal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, revisiting an unusual chapter of the 9/11 story in the remote community of Whitehorse.
Nobody died if it all worked out, but for a time there, people here were profoundly terrified and terrified for their own lives and the lives of their children.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
9 days into the special legislative session, there has been no visible progress on the major issues that led to a stalemate at the end of the regular session. While the Senate has made some concessions in its version of the capital budget, the big disagreement with the House is over the use of contingency language to protect projects from threatened gubernatorial vetoes. Anchorage Democrat Hollis French brought up the subject on the Senate floor today, supporting Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman of Sitka for adding the protection. He called it inverted logic for the governor to threaten vetoes depending on lawmakers' support for a bill cutting oil company taxes. And he said the Finance Committee was trying to provide a $400 million statewide energy program while the governor was, quote, swinging his veto axe.
So the co-chair from Sitka thinks, how do I protect these necessary projects? And he thought up an excellent response to the problem. You weld all those projects into one statewide energy package that does something for every single region of the state. E pluribus unum, Mr. President, out of many, one. And he used contingency language in the capital budget that said, if one is vetoed, they're all vetoed. It's the first time in the state's history this has been done exactly this way. The senator from Sitka, I think, he thought up a better mousetrap, an interesting twist on an old device.
French referred to the governor's position on the subject when he was a member of the Senate. In 1997, Parnell voted for a budget that contained several sections of contingency language.
Indeed, 2 years later, when he was co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, he said, I would never waive the legislature's right to include conditional language in an appropriations bill. He was sitting in the exact same seat that the senator from Sitka is sitting in today when he said that.
Minority Leader Charlie Huggins argued that while he likes the thought of an omnipotent legislature, he recognizes the need for a balance of power. He said the issues now center on how the two sides come to a solution with dignity.
Our attempts to tie the hands of the governor, no matter who it might be and who's running next year or the next cycle, I think that the balance of power and looking for, quote, a mousetrap is not statesmanship. It gets us to a lower level, in my estimation.
Neither House nor Senate Finance Committees met today, and there will be no business conducted during floor sessions. All are rescheduled for tomorrow. Following the debate on the Senate floor, Attorney General John Burns hastily called a press conference to counter arguments that the Senate's inclusion of contingency language is on solid legal footing. Burns said the use of packages of projects that could support each other against gubernatorial vetoes is invalid and unenforceable.
The simple reality is that the contingency and non-severability language violates the Constitution because it violates the governor's line item veto power by prohibiting the governor from striking or reducing any individual appropriation made in Section 4 of the Capital Appropriation Bill.
Burns said the writers of the Constitution intended having a strong executive branch with a strong control over the state's finances. He did not go so far as to advise the governor to veto the language items, saying that is premature until a bill is given to the governor. The latest capital budget compromise cuts more than $45 million worth of Southeast Alaska school maintenance projects. Damaged roofs, rotting walls, electrical upgrades, and numerous other repairs will have to wait unless they're restored. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Lauren Birch is worried about the sprinkler system at the Thorn Bay School.
Sooner or later, you have a catastrophic failure where, you know, you're flooding out parts of your school.
The small school on eastern Prince of Wales Island has already seen breakdowns that damaged classrooms, and he expects it to get worse.
The gym in particular is troublesome because you've got a wood floor, and you know that can't come out very well. You know, they get much water on them, you're replacing the whole floor.
Birch is superintendent of the Southeast Island School District, which includes 8 small schools on Prince of Wales and Baranoff Islands. He's worried that $670,000 for a new Thorn Bay sprinkler system has been cut out of the latest version of the Senate's capital budget. It also removed $4.5 million in roof, lighting, fuel storage, and other repairs in his district. Eugene Avey is also worried. His concern is with Metlakatla's elementary school.
We have a roof that is leaking and siding material that is rotting away. And it's just a tired building, and it's needing an update and upgrade.
Avey is superintendent of Southern Southeast's Annette Island School District. The capital budget had about $10.25 million to renovate the elementary school, and now it doesn't. The reductions in the capital budget total about $200 million statewide. It's from a list of major maintenance projects that Senate budget writers hope to clear up. Close to $75 million remains, but it will fund far fewer repairs. The total dropped as part of a compromise with House leaders who say the budget is too large. Some projects could be put back in. The funding requires a local match, which depends on community size and local government structure. Small rural communities outside boroughs pay only 2%. Cities that can bond for a share of the cost contribute up to 35%. There's also a separate program where districts sell bonds to cover 30% of eligible projects, and the state chips in the rest. The capital city often uses that mechanism. Its Senator Dennis Egan says that lessens the impacts of the capital budget cuts.
It doesn't make a lot of difference to Juneau right now, but it does make a lot of difference to other school districts that don't have the capacity to bond.
Smaller districts pay for some repairs on their own, but Southeast Island Superintendent Lauren Birch says type funding often means it's on an emergency basis.
Basically, you're choosing between a teacher and, fixing a roof. And it's always a very difficult thing. And when we try to put that into the kids, we're always going to come up short on the repairs.
The Senate capital budget preserves some education projects. That includes major construction projects in western villages. In Southeast, there's money to expand a dormitory at the University of Alaska's Juneau campus. The now $2.68 billion spending plan also continues to fund a large number of energy projects, a sticking point with the House and the governor. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
University of Alaska Fairbanks research shows tiny marine life in Port Valdez was slow to recover following the 1964 earthquake. UAF scientists tracked invertebrates in deep water and intertidal zones of Port Valdez following the 9.2 magnitude quake. Their findings were recently published in the journal Marine Environmental Research. Assistant research professor Arnie Blanchard says it took decades for some species to recover after the quake moved massive amounts of sediment over the deep sea floor.
Those ones that would take more time were still in the process of coming into the fjord in 1971, and it was not until like into the 1980s that they seemed to be able to reestablish some semblance of a balance in the basin. And then our data suggests that it was not until about 1990 that they really reached a point of equilibrium.
Blanchard says a study led by UAF's Dr. Howard Fader that looked at the tsunami-scoured near-shore environment of Port Valdez also showed drawn-out recovery for some species like mussels. Blanchard says the research may transfer to other more recently earthquake-impacted areas like Japan and Indonesia.
The patterns of recovery and the time frames are likely to be different. Who knows how long those would take, like down in Indonesia, but more northern environments. We can expect things to take quite a bit of time to recover.
Blanchard says the shape of the glacial formed fjord at Port Valdez restricts water exchange between surface and deeper environments, a challenge to rebuilding marine life after a catastrophic event like an earthquake and tsunami. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a federal program is helping more Alaska farmers go organic.
I put probably 3 tons in storage for the winter of the various types of potatoes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
A new documentary investigates a bizarre chapter in the horrifying events of 9/11 that involved the remote Yukon community of Whitehorse. That morning, a Korean passenger 747 sent out a text message that made it seem as if it was being hijacked. The plane was supposed to land in Anchorage, but air traffic control diverted it to Whitehorse, sending panic through the community as parents raced to the school to collect their children.
And I was personally quite distressed myself because I didn't know what was happening with my child. I had all these kind of catastrophic thoughts about my boy going through some sort of disaster by himself.
Whitehorse filmmaker Max Fraser spent 5 years working on the documentary. He says the incident left a very deep impression on him, and he wanted to figure out why it happened.
I mean, we all woke up that morning in the Pacific time zone. You know, we heard something on the radio. We went and turned on our televisions. We saw what was happening in New York, and we were horrified and saying, oh, my God. And, you know, almost in the next breath, we said, thank God I live in the Yukon. Things like that will never happen here. Well, 4 hours later, we were at work. The kids were at school, and the police, the mounted police, come on the radio, say there's a hijacked airliner coming to Whitehorse. Public buildings and schools are being evacuated, and parents should go get their children.
Certainly, it seems the most disturbing element is the information about the squawk of 7500. Explain a bit about what that is and how you found out about it.
In the film, you know, I wanted to kind of explain what exactly happened and why. And when I went looking for an answer to why they thought it was hijacked and all these different stories, there were stories that, well, the pilot made an error. He meant to hit a low fuel signal on his radar squawk to air traffic control. There was a communication problem, you know, that kind of stuff. Nothing really added up. So I requested documents from the FAA under the U.S. Freedom of Information laws, and they sent me 90 minutes of audio tape between air traffic control and the Korean airliner, as well as the fighter jets. And that audio tape is just chilling in terms of portraying the drama of the day. And the airliner, like most airliners flying long-distance flights, they have a radar code called a squawk. So Korean Air Flight 085 was squawking 5255 when it entered Alaska airspace. At a certain point that day, an order came from Washington, D.C., Federal Aviation Headquarters, to Anchorage Air Traffic Control to tell Korean Air 085 to change its squawk from 5255 to 7500. And that is an extremely bizarre kind of instruction.
And the 7500 squawk means we've been hijacked. Is that correct?
That's right. 7500 is reserved for hijack. It means only one thing. So there was no doubt. And why Washington ordered that plane to squawk 7500 is quite a mystery, because it's so unusual. That signaled to the military and others that a hijack condition was confirmed and real on that plane, and brought that plane that much closer to being shot out of the sky.
Does it seem odd that the pilot, the Korean pilot, didn't question this order? You do have the audio exchange between air traffic control and the pilot. It was well established that the pilot spoke and understood English well. There wasn't a language barrier here. And he just confirmed and didn't question it. Does that seem odd?
Well, it seems very odd. The pilot did ask the air traffic control to confirm that they wanted the plane to squawk 7500, and air traffic control confirmed that, but you can hear the disappointment in the flight crew's response where they say, Roger. The tone of voice goes down. It's like, man, what the heck is going on here? I think it was just a day of very extreme circumstances and decisions, but it's the 10th anniversary, and surely it's time to get a proper explanation.
And what about today? What do folks in Whitehorse say about that experience? Are they resentful of the United States feeling, and do they feel, well, we must have been considered more expendable than people in Anchorage because they sent this potentially what they thought was a dangerous aircraft to us? What's the sentiment there now?
Well, the biggest thing in making the film was everybody had a story to tell. So my challenge as a filmmaker was, here's 20,000 people, 20,000 stories. How could I possibly, tell them all? But the memory is vivid. It is deep in the experience of everybody who lived here that day. The people are baffled by why a hostile aircraft was sent to Canada. People are baffled about why a hostile aircraft sent to Canada was sent to Whitehorse. You know, there's no resentment, I don't think. There's just a kind of wondering about, why did our friends in Alaska send us this hostile aircraft? We just don't get it. I mean, nobody died. It all worked out. But for a time there, people here were profoundly terrified and terrified for their own lives and the lives of their children.
Max Fraser's documentary is called Never Happened Here, the Whitehorse 9/11 story. It doesn't yet have an air date in the United States. The city of Dillingham is hoping to annex the Nooshaghak Commercial Fishing District. The move could bring in an extra $700,000 in tax revenue each year. People for and against the proposal voiced their opinions at a public hearing last night in front of the state's annexation board. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
The city of Dillingham is proposing to bring the Nooshaghak Commercial Fishing District and the Wood River Special Harvest Area into the city boundaries. That would increase the size of the city by 396 square miles of water. One of the expert witnesses called by the city of Dillingham was George Canellis. He's a community planner hired by the city to help with the annexation proposal. Canellis is perhaps best well known as the former federal co-chair of the Denali Commission, a job he left in 2009. Much of his testimony was focused on the importance of hub communities in rural Alaska, and he stressed that Dillingham is the obvious hub for much of Bristol Bay.
That if this proposal were not to be approved by the commission and were not to be approved by the voters, I do see a continued gradual decline in the finances and in the well-being of Dillingham.
The contention by the city, which was repeated several times by the sworn witnesses who testified Monday night, was that the city's finances are stretched dangerously thin. The city imposes a 13-mil property tax, a 6% sales tax, and very large taxes on alcohol and lodging. That makes Dillingham one of the most heavily taxed cities in Alaska. However, the contention that the city's finances are in trouble was disputed by an expert witness called by the attorney representing the Eacock Village Council. Greg Erickson is an economist who runs a consulting business in Juneau. He participated in Monday night's public hearing by phone, and he outlined what he found out after reviewing the audited financial statements for the city dating back to 2006.
No municipality that has its general fund reserves increasing over 5 years at an annual rate of 13% per year can fairly be characterized as teetering on the edge of a fiscal precipice.
Erickson also contends that the reason why the Dillingham Harbor operates at a deficit and requires support from the city's general fund is because the city has decided not to charge fees at a level large enough to support the harbor. The man who has taken the lead in the opposition to the annexation proposal is commercial fisherman Robert Hyano from Dillingham. He's the president of the Eacock Village Council. During his sworn testimony Monday night, Hyano called into question the importance of the Dillingham Harbor and the other services provided by Dillingham to the commercial fishing fleet that fishes each summer in Nooshigak Bay. He claims the set netters at Ecock Beach would not benefit if the commercial fishing district were brought into the boundaries of Dillingham.
We know from written comments that for approximately 200 to 300 drift fishermen, it has no importance at all. I ask you this, to consider this. If a harbor is so essential to the commercial fishing in Bristol Bay, why is there no harbor in the Naknek-Quijack district or the Igigik district? Both of these districts produce harvests equal to or greater than the Nooshigak.
The public hearing in front of the State of Alaska's Local Boundary Commission will continue tonight, with the decisional meeting of the commission expected to follow the conclusion of the public hearing. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Organic farm products are carving their own niche in Alaska's grocery markets, although getting organic certification can be a challenge. Now, organic growers, or those with aspirations to further their participation in the locally produced produce movement, can get help through the USDA's Organic Initiative Program. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Alaskans aren't no slouches when it comes to making the most of what nature provides. Organic farmers like Palmer's Alex Davis have worked hard to bring locally grown organic vegetables to city buyers.
I also raise turkeys, ducks, geese, pigs, and chickens for eggs.
Davis and a partner run an outdoor farm market stand in Anchorage 2 days a week, and he supplies restaurants too. Right now, he's selling last season's parsnips and potatoes.
I put probably 3 tons in storage for the winter of the various types of potatoes. I just kind of chip away at them and sell a couple 100 pounds a week to various customers.
Soon, though, he'll be planting for the summer's haul of fresh lettuce, radishes, zucchini, and carrots, all certified organic. The federal National Organic Program sets the national rules for organic certification. Those rules are concerned with the quality of the soil that the produce is grown in. It must have 3 years free from any substances not on an approved NOP list. Alaska doesn't have its own organic certification program. There's too few small farms here interested in organic farming to justify a state program. Instead, the state has a memorandum of understanding with Washington State, and those farms that want to go organic can receive inspections and certifications through the Washington program, or they can get certification through the NOP. Now help is available for organic producers or those who want to transition into organic farming through the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service Agency's Organic Initiative. Conservationist Al White with the NRCS.
We have $338,000 available, and right now we don't have enough applications to use up all of those funds.
White says that's Alaska's share of the $50 million available nationally this year to help producers plan and put into practice conservation procedures which are in line with organic production under NRCS's Environmental Quality Incentives Program. These plans could include typical farming practices like crop rotation or pest management, as long as they are consistent with organic standards. Or they could be used to get into organic farming for the first time.
Probably the most important things under this program would be the development of an organic plan of operation for the farm, and also how and what kinds of fertilizers and soil amendments could be used in that operation and still maintain a certified organic operation.
Successful applicants could receive financial payments and technical assistance in conservation practices.
There's so much interest now, particularly in Alaska, of producing locally produced food by local farmers for local consumption. And while many of the products that are produced here and sold locally might meet organic criteria already, this program would allow folks to transition to become a certified organic producer, and that designation would allow them to advertise their product as organic, and there would be an economic advantage to be able to market it that way.
Applications can be submitted through NRCS offices or online. They are due May 20th, but White says applications will be accepted after that date for the next round of funding. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A renowned educator and advocate for incorporation of indigenous worldviews and observations of nature into Western education has passed away. Dr. Oscar Kawagli died in Fairbanks on Sunday after a long struggle with cancer. He was co-director of the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative and the Alaska Native Knowledge Network and taught at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Cross-Cultural Studies for more than 20 years. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Dr. Oscar Kawagli was raised on the Kuskokwim Delta by his grandmother, who encouraged him to excel in education. He was the first Yupik to graduate high school in Bethel. He went on to obtain master's degrees in education and science and a PhD in education. Senior Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Natives Nelson Anapuk says beginning in 1972, he worked with Kawagli in education and at the Alaska Native Corporation Chalice. He says Kawagli was also part of a project at AFN.
Him and Frank Hill and Dr. Barnard from University of Alaska were absolutely dedicated to improving the life education of the Alaska Natives. And at the same time, at that point, him and Dr. Barnard and Frank Hill were working together to talk about the positive contributions of the Alaska Natives into Alaska society.
Kawagli wrote a book, co-authored others, and wrote numerous articles on the topic of Native ways of knowing. He also lectured extensively across the United States and Australia, New Zealand, and several Arctic nations. Oscar Kawagli was 77. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
One answer to our state's declining oil production, Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.